Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Here's a story for you. There's a small town in Alabama where the rumor was a local clergyman named Reverend Willie Maxwell used voodoo to kill five members of his family over a period of 7 years. It started with the murder of his first wife, Mary Lou, and then he married the next door neighbor, and she died too. You got the idea. For years, the Reverend evaded punishment and kept collecting insurance money with each new death. That was until the Reverend was shot to death while attending a funeral of his last victim. It gets a little crazier. The Reverend's killer was exonerated in large part due to his attorney, a notable politician whose previous client was, wait for it, the Reverend himself. The case was the subject of a project called The Reverend by an Alabama novelist trying her hand at true crime, but the book was never finished. Why and how Harper Lee didn't finish something she worked on for years is a mystery itself, one that is explored in a new book from my next guest. Casey Sepp is an investigative reporter for The New Yorker and The New York Times, and she has written Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. Casey, welcome to All of It.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did you come upon this story of the Reverend and Harper Lee?
Yeah, I mean, what an unlikely thing to learn Harper Lee was up to in the years after To Kill a Mockingbird. I found out about this case in 2015 when, like a lot of other reporters, I went to Alabama to look into this other manuscript of Harper Lee's that had been found and was about to be published, her novel Ghosts at a Watchman. And, you know, there were a lot of questions about the provenance of that manuscript and about her ability to consent to publication. And so, like a lot of reporters, I was, you know, nosing around town trying to find out about her life and about the folks who were overseeing her affairs. And while there, I learned of this other project she had undertaken in the 1970s on the other side of the state involving the voodoo preacher.
So was this myth down there? Did people know about this, or was this something that you stumbled upon?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these kind of interesting incongruities. It was very well known in the area. Obviously, Harper Lee, during her reporting, you know, interviewed dozens of people, encountered, you know, a lot of folks who had worked these cases as law enforcement officers, or they had been attorneys who worked these civil or criminal cases. And she just went around town. She went to cocktail parties and had dinner with folks. And so everyone around Lake Martin knew that she was working on this book, but that knowledge had not permeated the outside world. And so there's a little bit of a footnote in the other biographies and biographical writings about her. And so I was completely surprised by it. And the more I learned, the more substantial it seemed her effort had been. And she really had, you know, moved to town for almost a year and then spent years after that trying to turn her reporting and investigative work into a book.
It is so interesting when you go to small communities like that and they're like, oh yeah, everybody knows that.
Yes, the phenomenon of everybody knows that. And of course, nobody outside of there knows that. Yeah, I mean, really, really richly rewarding to get to hear those stories that, quote, everybody knows. And same thing is true in New York, actually. I hope that one of the truly delightful things for readers of this book is to realize that, you know, Harper Lee lived most of her adult life in New York City, and she made her way around town. She was at the Met, she was at the Frick, she was drinking at Elaine's, and, you know, same thing, quote, everybody knows it, but nobody knew it.
And I was going to ask you this at the end, but we were just talking about it. She was neighbors with Hall & Oates. That's just a crazy detail.
Yeah,
in the book.
So they actually didn't know it. You know, a small town building. No, she lived on the Upper East Side up on East 82nd Street. And she lived in the same building from the late 60s and until she had a stroke and moved home to Alabama in the aughts. And in that period of time, you know, people moved in and out of that building the way they do in New York. And so at one point in time, before they were famous, you know, Daryl and John were her next door neighbors on the first floor of that building. So yeah, what a delightful coincidence of geography for them and for her.
I love that about this book, is there are all kinds of those little granular details that it's so interesting. The name of it is Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. So at the time that she was starting to be interested in this and moving to Alabama, she'd been a recluse for a while. And you write about her, not a recluse, she just wasn't in the public eye, that Lee herself had no patience for the budding Harper Lee industrial complex. Was this project to get away from that?
Yeah, she certainly had a little bit of an allergy to publicity. So I think, you know, you already self-corrected around recluse. And just because you don't want to talk to the press or the news media doesn't mean you're reclusive.
Exactly.
You know, she had this idea, kind of an admirable one, about the notion that, you know, authors were not meant to be celebrities and their work should speak for them, and their private life, you know, had little to no relationship to their work. And so she didn't like interviews. She didn't like talking to the press, and she did like talking to other people though. And so she actually was an incredible reporter. She had helped Truman Capote with In Cold Blood, gone out to Kansas, door knocked there, interviewed folks in their official capacities for the book that he wrote, In Cold Blood. And there again, when she goes to Alexander City, Alabama, to work on her book, The Reverend, she does the same thing. She's very gregarious. She's very friendly. She's very charming. A lot of the folks I talked to said, you know, she was one of the most interesting people they ever met, and she was down to earth and unassuming. And, you know, they were truly surprised to learn she was the author of such a famous and successful book. And you know, many, many years later, you know, 40, 50 years later in some cases, it was still, you know, the highlight of their life, the day they met Harper Lee, and the kind of deep connection they felt to her. And these are people who maybe just had pimento cheese sandwiches with her over lunch, or, you know, she signed a copy of the novel for their child. And so, you know, she made an impression, and that was wonderful to be able to collect those stories and offer a new portrait of her in the book.
How did you go about it? What were you reporting 1, 2, 3s?
Geez, I mean, I like to say, you know, go and stay. You go to a place and you stay as long as you need to. And with a book, you know, I was lucky enough to get to do it. And some people who didn't want to share their Harper Lee stories on the first visit maybe did on the third or fourth. And my favorite example of that is actually another reporter. And, you know, he's a 21-year-old Cub reporter, and he was the only member of the news media there the day the Reverend was gunned down. And he drew the short straw. It was a Saturday. Nobody else wanted to go cover this funeral, and he's there. And right as he's about to leave, 3 shots are fired. He rushes back into the funeral home. And so he's a wonderful source for Harper Lee as she's trying to learn about that original case. And actually, they had a very long friendship until she died. That reporter visited her in New York. You know, they went to the symphony together. They mailed books back and forth. They exchanged letters. And I kid you not, probably the first 5 times they interviewed him, he pretended like he never knew her name. And then finally, you know, when he decided he could trust me, and when he decided this was going to be a book that took her seriously as an intellectual and as a real literary force, you know, he said, I may have talked to her some. And then it turned out he talked to her a lot, and then he shared the letters. And so, yeah, I think it just takes patience and persistence. So I was lucky that a lot of folks did decide to cooperate and share their letters. You know, there's a lot of new correspondence from Harper Lee in the book. And I hope that even though I can't offer much of the manuscript known as The Reverend, I do, you know, bring together a lot of her voice and a lot of her writing that I think will be satisfying for folks who just want to read more of her work.
And I also think people don't want to think you're just parachuting in and out,
taking their
story and leaving.
Yeah, which is, again, you know, Harper Lee is a great role model in this respect. She made quite the impression in Kansas, too. And by contrast to Capote, people really trusted her, and they felt she was empathetic and honest and forthright. And she maintained lifelong relationships with some of the families out there, too. And in that way was just a really good role model for learning about a community you're not a part of and treating people's pain and suffering sensitively. Because, of course, you know, on the one hand, this is a sensational story and it reads like something out of a tabloid. On the other hand, you know, a lot of people lost people very close to them, and there are survivors in this community, and there is intergenerational trauma around this story. And you want to make sure that you treat everyone with respect, not just the world famous writer, but everyone in these small towns who lived through this.
My guest is Casey Sepp. The name of her book is Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. As you organized your book, you organized it into 3 parts about the Reverend, the attorney, and then the writer. Why did you do that? Let's start with that. Why that organization?
Sure. I mean, this is one of those great, you know, post hoc questions. I would love to pretend it was a hard choice. It was the obvious choice. I love characters, and I actually really love religion and politics and literature. And so it seemed to me like I wanted to put these lives in conversation with one another, but I wanted them to be discreet. You know, if you tried to braid them in any more deliberate way, it would erode some of the real differences between these lives. And so William Maxwell was an African-American preacher born to sharecroppers in a small town in Alabama. And the larger forces operating on his life and the opportunities he had, the limited opportunities mm-hmm. he had, are so distinct from someone like his attorney who, you know, William Maxwell served in the Army, but he never got any higher than an engineering assistant. And his attorney enlisted in the Army and went immediately into the JAG Corps. So right away, you just want to make sure you preserve the distinctions and the differences between these lives. And same thing for Harper Lee. She came from a family of means. She got to study abroad at Oxford. She could move to New York to pursue a creative mm-hmm. lifestyle. And, you know, you want to show how three similar lives could be so different. And so I wanted that juxtaposition. But I didn't want to make them seem more similar than they were. You know, their intersection between these three people was very brief, spectacular, but very brief. And so I wanted them to each have a standalone section so they could get their due. And we could really learn about, you know, their whole lives, not just the moment where they intersected with one another.
I do want to ask a few questions about the actual crimes themselves.
Sure.
The Reverend, was it clear to people in Coosa County that he was killing people? Was that just people accepted that and that he was just getting away with it?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the reasons I think that this was a difficult book for Harper Lee to write. The truth of the matter is, you know, there were five, if not six, deaths attributed to the Reverend Willie Maxwell, but not all of them were declared homicides. In some cases, no cause of death was even determined by the state crime lab. So, you know, to call them homicides is already a tricky category. And even those that were declared homicides, he was only tried for one murder, and he was acquitted of the murder of his first wife. Now, you alluded to the reason for that, which is he married the state star witness. She changed her testimony and became the second Mrs. Maxwell. So, you know, was it clear? I mean, sure, but there's a country mile, you know, between what's clear and what you can prove in a court of law. So he was never convicted of any of these crimes. And the clarity that folks around him in Coosa and Tallapoosa County had did not correspond to convictions. I think that for most of them, what was most telling is the number of insurance policies that he held on all of these individuals. So you might have thought it was coincidence, and you might have thought, as he said, that, you know, these were the kinds of trials visited upon Job, and that someone was framing him, or that some evil force was out to get him. But in all of these cases, he held insurance policies, and in most cases, sizable insurance policies on these individuals. And the thing that, you know, some of the sheriffs in Coosa and Tallapoosa County would have me tell you is, you know, the death stopped after the Reverend was murdered. So I think that brought some clarity to folks, too.
It's great. You have a photo in the book of the various insurance policies.
It's a small sample, if you can believe it. Yeah. So, you know, when I say he held insurance, I think today folks think, oh, you have one policy on your spouse or, you know, on your children. And, you know, in this case, we're talking about, you know, 17 policies on one individual. And, you know, he was insuring the lives of uncles, aunts, nieces, nephews, brothers, infant children, and insuring them with multiple companies for multiple policies. And it was really just, you know, a kind of stock portfolio, if you will, of opportunities to profit from their death.
I want to talk about the attorney. His family was very helpful in writing of this book, and he had political aspirations. There's this great way you describe him, and you really get a sense of who he is. He wanted a photographer to take a picture of his family so they'd be Kennedy-esque. Those were his aspirations. How does someone like that end up defending the killer of a suspected murderer?
Sure. I mean,
and in terms of his political aspirations, on
sure.
top of it.
So one thing to say about Tom Radney, so he's a Kennedy liberal in the Wallace South, so those photographs are beautiful and his ambitions were sky high, but, you know, he was born in the wrong time and place for the politics he had. But his political career had basically come to an end by the time. So he was representing the Reverend starting in the late 60s, and he served in the state legislature in that period and then ran for lieutenant governor of Alabama. But by the time he's defending the Reverend in these civil and criminal cases, his political career was mostly over, and he lost that race for lieutenant governor, and he'd come back to small-town lawyering. And much like, you know, the kind of difficult case for liberalism in the South, he liked hard cases, and he would take almost any client who came knocking, and he believed in, you know, good, competent legal representation for anyone. And of course, one thing to say about Tom Radney, this lawyer, is, you know, the first time a reverend comes to you needing to be defended in a murder trial for the death of his first wife, you know, hindsight is different. At that time, he just needed to be defended in the murder trial of his first wife. And so I don't think anyone begrudged Tom Radney defending him the first time. It's just as these cases piled up and the bodies piled up too, that it raised eyebrows. And so defending the vigilante who murdered the Reverend was in some ways the chance to change the narrative about his lawyering too. But I would be remiss, you know, it's a bit like Hall & Oates. The Reverend had another kind of notable lawyer And he just has a tiny bit part in the book. But Fred Gray is one of the most extraordinary civil rights attorneys in Alabama history. And he actually represented the Reverend, too. And that was in one of those insurance cases. And, you know, it's easy to tell a story like this and think that the fraud and predation was only on the part of customers. But, of course, this was an extremely exploitative time in the life insurance industry. And they denied coverage to black clients, or they overpriced the policies, or they sold them substandard policies. And, you know, a lot of that inequality and discrimination was only solved a few years ago with these class action lawsuits. But Fred Gray, who had represented Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., steps up and takes this case with the Reverend because there was an insurance company trying to deny him payment. So not that the Reverend was a poster boy for civil rights by any means, but, you know, again, Tom Ratty was in good company. Fred Gray represented the Reverend. And, you know, it was an interesting time in the history of Alabama. And I think the way this case looks from, you know, from today is not how it looked in 1970 right. or 1972 when, right. you know, you had an upstanding reverend who was, you know, who had made his policy payments and, you know, deserved the payout. Now, again, folks changed their opinion of the reverend once, you know, wife number two was found murdered and, you know, all these deaths were attributed to him. But yeah, Tom Radney's political career forms the second part of the book. And he served in the legislature with folks like Fred Gray. So it's nice to just take this small town story and have it collide with, you know, maybe the Alabama politics folks know from, you know, the gubernatorial years of George Wallace and what was going on in the kind of larger narrative of the Deep South at this time.
The name of the book is Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. It's by Casey Sepp. She is my guest. There's a lot, you spent a lot of time on the friendship between Harper Lee and Truman Capote and Harper Lee's assistants.
Yeah, assistant researchist. Yes, this extremely condescending term that Capote used for. He told it to George Plimpton. George Plimpton was writing about him for the New York Times. And yeah, not really the line credit you might want if you had made several reporting trips with your dear friend and given him over 100 pages of reporting notes to help him with his book. But yeah, assistant researchist.
Do you think In Cold Blood was partly written by Harper Lee?
Oh, gosh. I'm just delighted. You know, when I first started writing this book, people would say, did I think that Truman Capote wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, which is this utter canard that, you know, is absolutely not true. And I love that now people are asking me that. But no, you know, there's a lot of correspondence that these letters she wrote to people in Kansas and Capote's fact checker at The New Yorker. And I quote from a lot of that in the book. And it's very clear she didn't write it. But what she did do is, you know, sit in on all of these interviews. She came with him in 1959. She came back with him in 62 and 63, and she really helped him make sense of this case, and she helped him get to know the people in Garden City and Holcomb, and she was a tremendous asset. But you know, part of the tragedy of her work on the Reverend is it's one thing to do a lot of reporting, it's another to write a book. And so I don't think it's fair to say that she wrote any portion of In Cold Blood, but she did help Capote amass all of the material that made that tremendous book.
She also had an issue with his sort of elasticity of the truth.
Yeah, what an elegant phrase right there. And it, you know, it's the kind of language she would have used. So in addition to, quote, assistant researchist, Capote went around using this phrase nonfiction novel, which was anathema to her because she believed, you know, Harper Lee believed there was this tremendous distinction between fiction and nonfiction. And you shouldn't invent dialogue and you shouldn't invent scenes. And you should never go beyond what the facts bear out if you're writing nonfiction. And so she was left with some objections to In Cold Blood because having been there for all of the reporting and having gotten to know the principal players and having sat through the trial of Hickok and Smith, she had her own opinions about the Clutter murders and about what had happened in that community. And, you know, she was in a position to know what people had actually said and what scenes had actually taken place. Mm-hmm. And she never aired those grievances publicly, but she did in these letters reflect her disapproval of the book. And to some extent, what she was doing in Alexander City with the Reverend was a kind of correction for that. And what she wanted to do was write a nonfiction book that was pure nonfiction, only facts, you know, just journalism. Now, you know, some people would say she failed where Capote succeeded because he did produce a book out of all that. So hard to know.
Do you think that manuscript exists of the Reverend?
You know, the roller coaster of reporting this book, you know, some days I was absolutely convinced it was going to arrive on my doorstep or somebody was going to take me, you know, inside the bank vault and there it would be. You know, I don't know if a full manuscript exists. People who knew her well in this period, some say it did, and she wrote the whole thing but chose not to publish it. The racial politics were too scandalous, or she was afraid of the Reverend's living accomplice, or she thought someone in the book might sue her. But there are a lot of people who knew her at this time who just say that she was really struggling, and she was struggling with depression and drinking, and the kind of writer's block that had characterized her whole career came back, you know, once she tried really writing this project. So there are two poles of opinion there. I definitely think, though, that there will be material. You know, there'll be something for us to read. It could be the reporting notes. It could be something mm-hmm. else. So there will be more of her work to read, even if it's not a full manuscript.
The name of the book is Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. It's by Casey Sepp. You'll be at Books Are Magic in Brooklyn tonight, correct?
Absolutely.
I really enjoyed your book. Thank you so much for coming to
Thanks
All of
so
It.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is All of It on WNYC. Stick with us. We have another hour.